In the summer of 1968, I received a letter from Arthur Hyman, who was then professor of Jewish philosophy at Yeshiva University, a good friend, who told me that he had just been appointed as editor of the Department of Jewish Philosophy for a proposed Encyclopedia Judaica, a proposed encyclopedia of things Jewish. And he asked me if I would undertake to write for this new encyclopedia, a signed article on the theme of heresy and heretics. I confess I was nonplussed for a moment, wondering how I'd won such a reputation as an authority in heresy. But a quick thought reminded me that the Maimonidean controversy had dealt principally on the charge of heresy, raised against those who attempted to define Judaism in terms familiar to the Greek categories of logic. And I thought that the assignment was not inappropriate, and I was glad to agree to do it. That summer, I wrote this piece and a number of other pieces that were subsequently requested and mailed them to Jerusalem, where the general editorship of the Encyclopedia Judaica was centered under the leadership of the historian Cecil Roth. And I sat down for what I felt would be a long wait. I must tell you that Jewish encyclopedias are notoriously dilatory in appearing. Often they are never completed. Someone once made a collection of Encyclopedia Judaicas, of Jewish encyclopedias, which never reached beyond volume Aleph, the first volume. We're people of the book. We love learning. Our scholars love to amass learning, but there is rarely the time, the competence, the wherewithal in order to complete this particular undertaking. Indeed, one of the prized possessions in my father's library was a copy of the first general encyclopedia in Hebrew ever produced. It was produced in Warsaw in the middle of the 1880s. And you guessed it, volume Aleph appeared and no other. That encyclopedia was called Ha'eshkol, which means in biblical Hebrew the cluster of grapes. And it's an interesting word because it's the attempt by Hebraists to find a native term which will translate the composite Greek term encyclopedia. The word encyclopedia is a coined word. It was done in the first millennium of this, first centuries of this millennium in order to have a word which would be represent a summa, a drawing together of the known categories of knowledge. It's a composite of two words, two Greek words, enkyklios, which means complete, the word cycle, that which is drawn together, and paideia, which was the very famous Greek word by which they expressed that which was humane, functional, useful in wisdom. Now, there was no Hebrew word for this kind of book. These kinds of books had never been devised during biblical days. But there was this word eshkol. And by some chance of language, it became the word in Talmudic times which represented the great scholar, the man who had mastered most systems of knowledge, the man who had taken and plucked each and every grape from the vine and somehow pressed them into the wine of knowledge. And it didn't hurt that the word eshkol, the familiar Hebrew word, was close to the Hebrew phrase ha'ish shekol bo, the man in whom there is everything, the man who has mastered all the disciplines. Well, in the 19th century in Poland, the Hebraists were trying to find a word which was native to Hebrew, which would express the word encyclopedia. But those who produced encyclopedias were eager above all else to sell them. And when you send to a librarian in Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or New Haven, a prospectus which tells her that she ought, or him, that they ought to buy a 20-volume Ha'eshkol, they don't know what is being produced. But when you say you have a 20-volume Encyclopedia of Judaica, this they can understand. They know they are to be a reference library, and the encyclopedia is subscribed to and bought. So Hebrew simply transliterated the English encyclopedia, and so encyclopedia, and that's the word in Hebrew which is now used. In any case, I sent off this piece on heresy and heretics and some others, and lo and behold, much to my surprise, 3 years and 7 months later, Miss Lycan in our library received a large package from Israel, all 16 volumes of the completed encyclopedia, all 12,000 pages, all 11 million words. All of this produced in less than 4 years' time, which surely is a new world's track record for the production of encyclopedias. I'm told that just to prepare a revision of the familiar Encyclopedia Britannica requires 8 years from conception to delivery. And here, in a brief 4 years, we had an entirely new Encyclopedia Judaica. I was impressed. But I also know that haste can make for slovenliness. And I picked up these rather attractive volumes and I looked through them. They're beautifully bound and neatly put together. They're full of colorful illustrations. I've now read something over 100 pages in the encyclopedia, and I've yet to find a major typographical error. So obviously, haste did not represent slovenliness. But haste sometimes also makes for waste. And when I came to the last volume, the 16th, I discovered that at the end, there was an addendum, about 150 pages of articles, some of them of major significance, which obviously had not gotten to Jerusalem in time for a particular deadline and presumably will be repaginated into the texts themselves in a second edition. There was an eagerness, a conscious determination to produce this Encyclopedia Judaica in short order. And the question is why? What was the drive, the motivation? It's a fascinating kind of question because it involves two kinds of answers, one economic and one which has to do with the Jewish consciousness. The economic answer is self-evident almost. Unless you can produce this encyclopedia in relatively short order, you have paid for articles, you've paid for printing, you have money going out and no money coming in. Interestingly, when the prospectus of the Judaica was first sent to me, I was struck that upon opening the first page, the image that hit my eye was that of a computer. There was on one side a picture of a new kind of typewriter keyboard, and another side a picture of something which was called a Photon 433/10 Textmaster computer. And I was told that one of the interesting elements of this Judaica would be that from the time the article received the editor's it was received in the editor's office, it was simply checked, given to a secretary, typed onto a tape which would automatically print the book. The office of the publisher was capable of printing 300 new pages every working day. The Israel Office for Scientific Translation, which is a joint undertaking of the Hebrew University and of the Government of Israel, which was the official publishing house for this encyclopedia, has been one of the major income-producing businesses in Israel. They have cornered an area of the scientific and intellectual market because they can produce clean, fast copy accurately and quickly. This Institute of Scientific Translation is geared to print, to mail out complete, 50,000 pages a year. That's the equivalent of 500 to 700 books a year. And in 1971, I am told that they brought into Israel almost $2 million in clear profit from this undertaking. Well, this is the way this encyclopedia was produced. It's part of the New World. There's no little editor in the back room, you know, going over your text this way and that way, seeing that every word is spelled correctly, and then it's sent to a typist and brought back to another editor and reviewed by someone else and then stuck in a bin someplace until they're finally ready for the letter H and they're finally ready to put this up into print and to set the print by hand. 300 pages a day. Any wonder that our libraries are chock full to overflowing. But in any case, there's a second reason. This has to do more with, I suspect, the Hebrew consciousness, a Jewish consciousness, than it does to do with economics. The Encyclopedia Judaica was first proposed by a number of men who had somehow survived the Holocaust and who had been members of a team which, during the 1920s and early 30s, had been eager to produce in Germany, which was then the real center of Wissenschaft, of Jewish knowledge, a fine, classic Jewish encyclopedia. And they worked carefully, and soberly, and calmly, and accurately for almost 20 years. And during those 20 years, 12 volumes of a German Jewish encyclopedia were produced. They're a monument to accurate and careful scholarship. But that Encyclopedia Judaica, the Yiddish lexicon, goes only up to the middle of the letter L. And at that point, the Nazis came in, of course, and closed down the project. And these men were eager to complete the project that they had begun, and there was reconstruction money available to initiate the project. And the Encyclopedia Judaica, the new one, is in a sense the son or the grandson of this German project. And in order to keep that project alive, because most of the volumes of the German encyclopedia were destroyed, very few of them still exist, a number of the articles have been carefully translated from German into English and now appear in the new Encyclopedia Judaica, so they're kept alive. They're given a new home, a new visibility. And there was something about the statement, we're going to finish this one. Each of us, I suspect, wonders about whether or not Jewish life will survive, for how long. We're sure, but not quite that sure. We've had too many shocks and too many disappointments. 3.5 years, that's a gamble. But that's all the gamble they were willing to take with this new scholarly encyclopedia, and so it very quickly saw the light of day. Now, what we have in the Encyclopedia Judaica, which I have called the Book of the Year or the Books of the Year, is a summa, a collection of all that is known now about the major areas of Jewish life. Our history, our literature, rabbinics, Bible, the geography of Israel, the demography of all the places where there have been Jewish settlements, the great writers and teachers and philosophers and educators and scientists and men of affairs. But it's somewhat of an anomaly, because here we have an encyclopedia in English being produced in Jerusalem, where the language is Hebrew. Why then this anomaly? Why didn't they produce simply an Encyclopedia Judaica in Hebrew, which would be natural to the country? There are a number of answers to this. The first is one that deals with the eagerness of Israel to have a market for this new Encyclopedia Judaica. There is a 20-volume Encyclopedia HaIvrit, which is being produced, a general encyclopedia in Hebrew, which has some of this material in it. It will be some 35 volumes before it's completed. It obviously, there are only so many encyclopedias which can be sold to the Israeli public, and so it was natural to seek a new public. It was natural and it was deemed appropriate. Because one thing that Jews in the academic world constantly bump up against is massive ignorance of the Jewish tradition. The non-Jewish scholar, even when he is well-intentioned, has learned so little about the Judaic component of Western civilization as he has gone through a normal kind of modern general education. that he simply doesn't know how to blend it into whatever he is working on. And we've been eager, very eager, to have in a language which was open to the scholar, and English is of course the universal language today, an encyclopedia which would make it easy for him to look up a particular subject and to find there what he seeks and to know from there, from its bibliography and other suggestions in the article, where he can pursue further study in this area. There's also obviously the design upon us. They're eager in Israel that we become a better informed Jewish public in the diaspora. Because one of the things which bothers both Israel and the diaspora is the growing gap of information, rather knowledge and ignorance, which separate our two polities. Every Israeli learns Jewish history in his public schools. He knows the basic terms of Jewish life. He is familiar with the basic figures, heroes, symbols of our literature. His counterpart in the diaspora increasingly is not. And we are losing the ability to communicate easily, symbolically, in terms of a common idiom. And that would be unfortunate. And so there was design as well as economics in the decision to publish this encyclopedia in English. Now, there was also a design in the publication of this encyclopedia in Jerusalem. It could have been done in New York or in London, but it was done in Jerusalem deliberately for a number of reasons. In the first place, Israel looks upon itself as the natural center of Jewish life. It's interesting if you look back on the history of the writing of these great lexicons or encyclopedias. The first modern Jewish encyclopedia of Jewish knowledge was produced in Italy in the early 18th century. Italy was then the country of enlightenment. It had been through the Renaissance. And a man named Samuel ben Isaac Lampronti wrote, or on his own, an entire encyclopedia of rabbinic knowledge, which he called Pachad Yitzchak. And he completed it in the early part of that century, and it went through several editions. And then the center of Jewish learning moved from Italy northward into Central Europe, into Germany. And in the middle of the 19th century, we had in Germany the first modern critical encyclopedia of Jewish knowledge, which was called the Reale Encyclopedia des Judentum, the basic encyclopedia of Jewish knowledge. It dealt with Bible, it dealt with Talmud, it dealt with the traditional intellectual themes of Jewish life. And then the center moved to these shores. And between 1901 and 1906, the great Jewish Encyclopedia, which has been the standard work of that nature in Judaism, was published in New York and in Philadelphia. And now finally, the Encyclopedia moves to Jerusalem, the natural home of the Jews, and hopefully the permanent center of Jewish learning. And it's interesting because if you open the book, look at the cover, it's a beautifully bound bluish cover. You see imprinted in a darker blue on the cover the line from the prophets, "From Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." They're very proud of the fact that now Jerusalem, the Hebrew University, the great libraries of the city, the great museum is the center. Jerusalem, Zion. These themes are elemental in this story. Now, every encyclopedia, and this is the only reason why it's really worth talking about them, reveals something of its time and of its place, something of the nature of Jewish life at a particular moment in history. If you look back at the great Jewish encyclopedia produced here in the United States 70 years ago, you find that it's in the book of enlightenment for the enlightened. The articles are signed. The articles are, for the most part, beautifully written. They have been gone over and checked and rechecked for total accuracy. They are liberal and reasonable. They are written with a concern for the understanding of the non-Jew. Words which are unique to Judaism are explained in ways that a non-Jew might understand them. It is a work of the best and highest kind of scholarship. It's calm, it's cool, it's scholarly. But if you look carefully, you'll discover that there's very little in this encyclopedia about the folk, about people, about cities, about buildings, about ideas, about traditions, about monuments, about works of literature, but almost nothing about the teeming millions in Eastern Europe. Very little about the Yiddish language or Yiddish literature. Very little that's open and free about mysticism, Hasidism, and Kabbalah. What you have in the Jewish Encyclopedia is a reasonable Judaism, reasonably presented for reasonable people. It's a great book. I was weaned on it, as almost everyone in my generation. You can trust what you find there. But it reveals the America, the England, the Central European Jewish scholarly mentality of the age. We were coming into an age where people would understand each other better. It was assumed that the folk, the teeming mass, would somehow take on our coloration. It was assumed that Judaism was not only an intellectual undertaking and a spiritual exercise and not a group of folk ways and superstitious practices and all the things which people inevitably overlay on a great faith. If you turn to the new Encyclopedia Judaica, you find some interesting things. You find, of course, all that's happened in Jewish history in the last 50 years. You find the Holocaust. You find Israel. You find much more emphasis on the here and the now, on things and on people. Yiddish, the language, the folk. Almost every little community in Eastern Europe where there was once a center of Jewish life has a little bit of an article about it. Every center of Jewish life in throughout the Arabian countries has some article about it. There's an attempt here in part as a memorial to those who died in the Holocaust, in part a deliberate and conscious effort to make Judaism be what, as broad as the Jewish people themselves, and not simply the Judaism of the head and of the heart of the finest, the noblest, the paragons among us. You have a measure here of what has been learnt in the last 50 years. And the measure is an interesting one. Almost single-handedly, a scholar like Gershon Scholem from the Hebrew University has mined the area of Jewish mysticism, of Kabbalah, of Hasidism. And he has brought to this encyclopedia, because he was the editor of these sections, an understanding of the psyche, of the unconscious of the Jew, which does not appear in any other work of this kind that I know of. You can pick up here and read about the non-reasonable, the unreasonable, the natural parts of Jewish life. When the Jewish Encyclopedia was written in the early 1900s, Salman Schechter, who was later to be the president of the Jewish Theological Seminary, had just begun to do the basic research in the materials which had been found in the Cairo Geniza, in the storeroom of the synagogue in Cairo, where a treasure trove of literature was found dating from the 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th century, the time of the Crusades. Now that work has almost been completed. If you pick up this encyclopedia, you can read of the meaning of the Geniza, how it has filled in blank pages in our history. The same, of course, about the Dead Sea Scroll peoples in Qumran. But the most striking thing about this new encyclopedia is its emphasis on people, on land, on life, and on the living. The geography of Israel is laid out before you in infinite detail. The archaeology of Israel, each of the kibbutzim, its nature, its forms, the forms of education, of social work, of hospitalization and health in the new land. Hebrew, the new Hebrew, not simply the classic Hebrew. The theater, the modern Hebrew theater. Writing, modern Hebrew writing. All this jumps at you from these pages. And whereas in the Jewish Encyclopedia of the early 1900s, you had the sense of watching a religion which was somehow of the past, here you have the sense of looking at a people who are very, very much in the present. If the Jewish Encyclopedia, as I have read it over the years, seems to be always a little bit looking over its shoulder to say, how will I present this in the best possible way so that the non-Jewish scholar may understand? The modern Encyclopedia Judaica seems always to be looking over its shoulder a little bit and saying, how will a mythic, consensus, traditional Zionist Jew take what I am writing? Because remember this, every encyclopedia has a point of view. Take the earliest editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica, open to Judaism, and you will read about a religion that never was and never will be. You will read about a Judaism which existed only in the minds of a 19th century Anglican cleric who had never bothered to go to a synagogue in London to find out what the living faith was all about. Judaism began with Abraham and ended with Jesus, and from ever after the Jews were a wandering people. Now that's been changed over the years. And I cite it only because we tend to be told by school librarians when we're growing up that encyclopedias are clean pages and trustworthy. Encyclopedias are written by people, just like any other book. And they reflect all of the biases of the author, and in the case of the encyclopedia, all of the biases of an editor. Let me illustrate from my own article, because heresy and heretics offers a fascinating problem. Who is the heretic? Is the heretic the authority against which a true believer is in rebellion? Or is he the radical who believes so deeply that he can no longer accept the compromises of the authority? When I submitted my article originally, I began it this way. Heresy designates ideas judged intolerable by those who control the religious apparatus. That was as neutral a way as I could find to say what I wanted to say. Heretics are those who espouse such beliefs or abide the special practices they entail. The heretic may be bitter or cynical or defiant, but he is not an apostate, which is another Talmudic word, and often believes that he, the heretic, represents true Judaism. I tried to be the scholar, the neutral. But when I sent this in to Jerusalem, a yeshiva bocher in Jerusalem got a hold of it, and I got back the following corrections. Heresy, belief in ideas contrary to those advocated by religious authorities. Not judged intolerable, but contrary to. The heretic may be distinguished from the apostate in that although he holds beliefs which are contrary to accepted doctrine, he does not renounce his religion entirely. The whole sense that the heretic may be in the right and the authorities may be in the wrong has been dissipated, and now we have a paragraph which will satisfy the most orthodox rabbi in Jerusalem. I argued a bit. I didn't win completely. Here's the way it finally appeared. Heresy, belief in ideas contrary to those advocated by religious authorities. A heretic may be distinguished from an apostate in that although he holds beliefs which are contrary to, and I stop this word, in currently accepted doctrines, he does not renounce his religion and often believes that he represents the true tradition. They won more than I won, but it's interesting in terms of the past. Again, let me show you from the conclusion of this article. I'm trying to talk of modern times when we've lost all patience with heresy hunting and censorship and this kind of thing. Here's my original article. When Moses Mendelssohn wrote that he knew of, quote, no rights upon persons or things which can properly have any connection with or dependence upon doctrine, end of quote, he was breaking entirely new grounds. In the 19th and 20th centuries, some liberal thinkers have argued on pragmatic and ethical grounds that mistaken notions can be opposed only by gentle reason and the example of the living community. But those who are bound by the terms of rabbinic Judaism retain the category of heresy and of concern for its control. And there have been any number of incidents in modern Israel where the Orthodox rabbinate has used the threat of cherem, of excommunication, in order to impose its will. This is the way the article came back. When Moses Mendelssohn wrote his Jerusalem, they now reinterpret the quote and take away the quotation marks, in which he maintained that no one should be punished for the opinions he holds, but only for the actions he commits, he was breaking entirely new ground. In the 19th and 20th centuries, liberal thinkers have argued, they took out completely unpragmatic and ethical grounds, have argued that mistaken notions should be opposed only by gentle reason. Now that kind of argument you might argue against. However, those who adhere to Orthodox Judaism can still find some meaning in the term heresy, though few modern religious authorities are likely to institute anti-heretical proceedings. Again, we've whitewashed, we've calmed down, we've made it seem as though traditional Judaism is far more liberal than, in fact, I believe it to be. There was a good bit of correspondence, and this is the way it finally appeared. Again, I won a little, lost more. When Moses Mendelssohn wrote his Jerusalem, he maintained that the community had no legitimate authority over anyone's opinions, an original argument, far-reaching in its consequences and breaking entirely new ground. In the 19th and 20th centuries, liberal thinkers have argued that all attempts at restricting ideas are self-defeating, and that mistaken notions can be opposed only by gentle reason. However, those who adhere to Orthodox Judaism can still find some meaning in the term heresy, but few modern religious authorities are likely to institute anti-heretical proceedings. Now, what do I say by all of this? Simply that behind every article, as behind every book, there's a story. There's an audience in the mind of the editor, and that audience, obviously, in this case, is the believing, gently believing, sweetly reasonable, Zionistically oriented Jew, and that it is this Jew to whom this book is most intended. Now, it's too bad that these kinds of changes were made. It's not a deliberate form of censorship, but it's a matter of editorial concern because these are signed articles. I know that a number of other men have had the same kind of experience with what they wrote. None of us care about matters of style, but these are matters of substance, of balance, of judgment. And it's too bad that this encyclopedia, too, will be someday critically reviewed by the scholars who will point out to the inconsistencies. And some of us will be blamed for having taken a point of view when, in fact, the original articles that we submitted may have been quite other. But having said all of this, this encyclopedia is remarkably competent, remarkably complete, and most important, remarkably alive. The Jewish Encyclopedia, which was published in the early 1900s in America, was a thing complete in itself. It was a number of volumes, thick, heavy volumes, full of knowledge, and no provision was made, and this is the interesting thing, no provision was made for any annual addition, for any increase of knowledge. It's almost as if there was the unconscious assumption in the minds of the writers that Judaism was finished and complete, a finite thing. But now we find an encyclopedia which is finished, but not finished, because this encyclopedia is designed to have an annual volume edition. Each year or each several years, new ideas, new discoveries, new people, new biographies will be added to what has appeared in the past. And we have the sense now of exuberance, of life. That, I suspect, is the most important comment which can be made on the basis of analysis of this book of the year. But somehow we Jews have found in the last 50 years, despite all the tension and all the tragedy and all the misfortune, a new sense of possibility. It's not only that life goes on, it's that new ideas are being forged, new books are being written, new philosophies are being organized, new ways of organizing Jewish life are being experimented with. That's what's reflected in this book. And that's why I thought to lay it before you today. It's in our library. Don't run and take out all 16 volumes. Miss Lichen will have a fit. But pick it up and read it, explore it. Some magnificent color plates of the medieval art of of our people, the ritual objects, the beautifully handwritten scrolls. There's some magnificent material on modern Israel. Anyone who's planning a trip to Israel should go and read the section on Jerusalem. It's the finest description of the history of Jerusalem and its geography I've ever seen put together. But more than this, pick it up. You look at the living sum of knowledge of our people, you'll be proud, and you'll have a sense of the vigor and the vitality of our Jewish experience. Amen.